The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Time for Capital Thinking, where we analyze the key policy, political, legal, and business issues that will shape America's future. Live from Washington, D.C., this is your unfiltered tour of the halls of power. Now, here's your host, Kevin O'Neill.
Hello, everyone. This is Vince Ferlicci. I'm filling in today for Kevin O'Neill. We've got a great show today. We're going to talk a lot about innovation with regarding patent reform and the largest patent reform bill since 1952 and when Dwight D. Eisenhower was president, the America Invents Act. And then we're going to talk about offshore wind, and we're going to talk about a green building of commercial buildings. So a lot of discussion about innovation and green tech. We're going to start it off first with Scott Chambers and Kevin Bell to talk about the issues regarding the America Invents Act. Scott Chambers is the chair of Pattenbaugh's Intellectual Property Department and advises clients on complex intellectual property matters, focusing on utilizing the courts and government agencies such as the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office to protect or defend clients' rights. Kevin Bell has a diverse practice representing national and multinational corporations, universities, and organizations in complex patent and trade litigation, International Trade Commission investigations, trademark and unfair competition litigation, and other issues around that space. Welcome to the show, Scott and Kevin.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
So the America Invents Act, it's the biggest patent reform bill done by Congress, legislation since 1952. Scott, can you tell us about the act and what it is, and for folks who may not know anything about it?
I'd be happy to. The America Invents Act is an act dealing with patent reform, which has been many years in the making. Congress first started working on this about 10 years ago. In the last 6 years, there has been at least one bill introduced into Congress every year trying to make changes in the patent system, trying to help to harmonize it with other patent systems in the world. And this particular change has given a lot more power to the Patent and Trademark Office, and it has it will in the long run make it less necessary to go into district court and litigate. Among the changes in the act are the conversion of the United States system from a first inventor to file, or the conversion to a first inventor to file from the old system, which was just the first individual to invent. It awards, this American Inventor Act awards a patent to the first person to file the patent application on an invention at the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, even if that filer wasn't the first to invent the subject matter of the application. Now, other radical changes in the U.S. patent system under the American Invents Act include potential post-review of patents that get issued, supplemental examinations to cure infirm patents, prior user defenses for individuals that have been practicing a particular type of an invention that they did not seek a patent protection for or that they decided was not patentable. And, limits to broad joinder rules that were permitted under the patent laws previously. Now, as I said before, the American Invents Act increases the power of the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office to determine the validity as well as the enforceability of patents. Over the next year and a half, the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office will be promulgating regulations to implement the American Invents Act, and these regulations could affect a number of business models. Significantly, though, the American Invents Act does not contain any language regarding the calculation of damages in patent infringement matters. Some of the early bills in the last 5 years dealt with trying to restrict the amount of damages that could be obtained for infringement, and some industries found this to be very much to their detriment, and other industries pushed hard for this. But when Congress finally looked at it closely, they decided that no consensus could really be wrought between these two viewpoints, and they decided not to put anything in that really went to damages. Now, the supporters for the American Invents Act include, you know, a lot of diverse industries like 3M and Apple and Dell and Facebook and General Electric and quite a long list of both large and small companies, but it's made quite a difference in the way that people look at, or it will make quite a difference in the way that people look at modern inventions.
Thanks for a very thorough review of that. I appreciate that, and I'm sure the folks listening do as well. I think the question that I think many people may have is this sounds so big and so so much of a change in this space. Is this the kind of thing, I know you mentioned there was going to be a year or so worth of rules promulgated, but as we're seeing with other major legislation that has been passed recently, notably the Health Care Reform Act and the Dodd-Frank Financial Regulatory Reform, the rules and the rulemaking process is moving extremely slow. For those that have to interact with this space, whether they have their own IP to protect or are simply inventors, is this the kind of thing where you would wait and see for a number of years how it actually turns out on the regulatory side when the law is interpreted by the regulators? Can you give us a sense of sort of the timing of all of that?
Well, the timing for the act. Each section or each subsection has its own time of implementation. Some of the act has already been implemented. In fact, some of the act went as we would say nunc pro tunc for litigations that were already in progress. The act ended some of those and different aspects of the act will go into force as the regulations are developed, but there's a pretty strict timetable. So that the switch to actually first to file will not really go into effect until after March 16th, 2013. What that does is it gives the Patent and Trademark Office time to get those regulations out, as well as train the people that will be needed to address some of the issues.
Got it. And the, dovetailing in your comment there back to the first to file, you know, that sort of seems like to an observer, someone, and to me, I've never really had any reason to intersect with patent law, and I'm sure some folks on the call or listening to the show, more correctly here, would be in the same boat. But this idea of first to file, so what this is that if I were to invent this widget, but I just didn't get around to filing it under the new law, if somebody else were to invent it 10 years later and then they went to file, they theoretically get the patent, sounds like. Doesn't that take away from the spirit of innovation a little bit?
Well, I don't think so. And the reason is that the reason for the patent system is to create benefits that others can build on. And if you come up with an idea and then you just sit on it, no one can build on that idea. As it is now, under the present system, if you came up with an invention and then someone else came up with an invention afterwards, and you both filed at the patent office, this could cause what is known as a patent priority dispute at the patent office, and interference is what they're often called, and this could go on for years before anybody could decide who was the real inventor. under the new America Invents Act, what happens is that the first person to file or the first person to publicly disclose the invention has a leg up. That you know, by filing, you protect your position, but also if you spoke about it publicly, you would have up to a year from that public speaking to get your invention on file. But your public speaking of the invention would preclude somebody else from slipping in and filing before you. So it really forces inventors to get the word out and either get the word out by getting something on file at the patent office or get the word out by talking about their invention. And that really stimulates the development of the technological arts.
Very interesting. So is this going to cause a flurry of filing? Are they just going to be backing up U.S. mail trucks from folks that have been sitting on these ideas?
I think what will happen is that if you've been sitting on an idea, you might want to get it on file pretty quickly. But as I had mentioned before, if you publicly disclose it, you've got a placeholder, and as you have spoken about your invention, if you were the first person to speak about it, then you've got up to a year to get that on file. The important thing is that it gets out into the public, and the public can build on it, and the public can use it.
We're going to take a break in a second and talk about the impact on businesses, but real quickly following up on that, what's the difference between speaking about it and filing it?
Well,
speak about it. Yeah.
Okay, just speaking about it, if I were to tell you that a new widget would get your floors cleaner much quicker, then that is known by the public and people can start to build on that.
All you need is a record of the fact that maybe you emailed me on this date and said, here's an idea?
Well, I don't think it would work for something like an email. And the reason, Vince, is that's not public. But if
right.
it was something that was public, such as you posted it on the Internet,
yeah.
then it would be something that would mark your place, that you actually came up with this before anyone else, and you disclosed this for the public to build on before anyone else.
Got it. Scott, Kevin, we're going to take a quick break and come back and talk about how all these are going to impact businesses in what already is an interesting, changing environment in every way. We'll be right back.
Stocks, bonds, investment opportunities, financial news, and talk. We can help. Call us now toll-free, 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
If you find yourself under the Klieg lights of a government investigation, you want experience on your side. Patton Boggs has 46 years of it. We've handled some of the biggest white-collar crime cases. Put that experience to work for you.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
It's all about action.
Touchdown!
Scores.
Taking a look at the NBA tonight.
Highlights.
He's broken loose. He's at the 30.
And headlines.
Big trade in the NFL this afternoon.
When you are looking to talk sports, look no further than the Voice America Sports Network. We bring you some of the biggest names and all the sports news you can handle. Whether it's basketball.
Off the glass.
Football.
Come on.
Golf. Racing. Or the Olympics. We've got you covered. We'll even cover tailgating. Tune in to the Voice America Sports Network. It's all things sports.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye.
The House will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs. Straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs, a bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to Capital Thinking. Vince Verlici filling in for Kevin O'Neill today. We're talking with Scott Chambers and Kevin Bell about the American Vents Act, the most significant change to our patent law system since 1952. And we talked a lot about in the first segment the actual changes and how patents are need to be filed going forward and timing and that sort of thing. I want to change here gears a little bit and talk about what this is going to mean on patent litigation as well as impact on businesses. So, Kevin Bell, could you tell us a little bit about what this is going to mean on litigation in the courts? I've read in the last couple of years that the courts have been jammed. Maybe I'm wrong, but I think it's what I've read, that there's been just a glut of litigation on these issues. And my guess is, if I'm right, that's why this law was created, was to try to streamline that and fix that. But can you give us some perspective on that?
Yeah, Vince, thanks. I think the American Vents Act is going to have potentially a profound impact on patent litigation in the U.S. court system. I think this new law will have us as patent litigators living in interesting times for a while. There are probably five or six big ticket items, I think, that come out that relate to patent litigation and companies in the United States. The last time I was on the show a few months ago, we talked about what are called false marking actions, which were people who had inadvertently left an expired patent on a product and were getting sued for it for damages. And they were bringing those actions on behalf of the U.S. government. So You had these holding companies that were being created that were then running out and suing people on behalf of companies for hundreds of millions of dollars sometimes for expired patents on things and claiming it was false marking. Congress took a big swipe out of that one in this bill. And at this point, now only the government can bring those actions themselves, which they probably won't do often, or private parties who can claim a competitive injury. So it would actually be someone who can claim that, this is causing me harm as a competitor of yours. Those are going to be the only people who have standing to bring these anymore, not just private citizens who form their own company.
What percentage of cases does that just knock right out then?
I knocked out, I think last time we talked, there had been over 1,000 of these cases filed in the last 18 months. I would say it knocked all but maybe 1% or less out. They're gone. And the reason is because the bill also had a retroactive effect on pending cases. So cases that had already been filed that related especially to expired patents were essentially the parties no longer had standing anymore. And I know in our practice we had three of these cases go away in one day because of the bill being passed on false marking actions. So that has had a profound impact alone right there, because those are being filed daily. I would say one of the other big issues, and a lot of this is relating to these non-practicing entities, which are patent-holding companies primarily, that monetize their intellectual property assets through licensing or litigation. There's been a rise in the last few years of those companies suing 20, 30, 40, 150 defendants in one case, all because they were alleged to infringe their patent. That's no longer going to be allowed. There's going to be more of a nexus between defendants than that. So you're going to have to file those cases individually against each defendant, unless you can show that, you know, they're all selling the same product, pretty much. So there's going to have to be much more of a relationship between the defendants and the allegations of infringement than there were in the past. And I don't know how much that's going to affect companies who bring these lawsuits, because quite honestly, really all it is it's going to make it more economically, it's going to make it more expensive for them to do this one at a time. I don't know how much it's going to curb litigation, and I think, you know, we're not going to know the results of that probably for, you know, a couple, 3 years until we really see a trend in that practice. But I think that is a significant change in the bill as well. Now, an interesting twist to that, or two interesting twists, is usually when multiple defendants get sued, they band together and they enter into joint defense agreements, and they try to cooperate and have scales of economy on defending themselves. Here again, now they'll all be being sued separately, and normally that kind of cooperation doesn't occur as easily when you're being sued in separate suits. However, the bill allows for defendants that do get sued in multiple defendant suits, instead of moving to dismiss those cases, they can waive that requirement under the statute and still stay together. So I think that'll be a very interesting thing to watch as we go forward as to whether how these larger companies want to react to what's been given to them in the statute. It's almost at their leisure. You can either not let it happen to you, or you can agree to let it happen to you and see if there's any scales of efficiency on defending yourself.
Got it. So how is this going to impact businesses? So you're put yourself in the CEO's chair. Now you're looking at this, or the general counsel's chair. You're looking at this new world, this new patent law. Obviously, if you had any intersection with the false marketing stuff, you know that's been kicked out or that's set aside. But now, if you're in the you're an innovator creating new jobs here in America by creating new ideas somewhere in some technological space, how is this going to impact you going forward?
Well, I think the way a CEO should look at it, I think any way any company should look at intellectual property when it goes to get patents, is that it's there for you to, it's an asset, and it's there for you to monetize that asset in one form or another. So if it's not serving any business purpose, then you shouldn't get any at all, because it probably doesn't assist you for the most part. I think what it's going to do for a CEO is it's going to have them change the way they spend their money. You know, hopefully this will reduce significantly frivolous lawsuits being filed against companies. It had an immediate effect on the false marketing. I think will have a long-term effect with other cases. I think it's going to also increase companies wanting to get their own house in order on their intellectual property portfolios, determine what they have and what they don't have. A lot of companies over time continue to get patents, and at some point in time, technology moves on, and they need to determine whether those patents, do they need to keep those alive? Should they license those to someone else? Should they sell them? Should they keep paying money for them if they're not using them? And I think one of probably the biggest incentives coming out of the American Invents Act for companies is that there's a huge incentive now to monitor your competitors' patents as they issue from the patent office, because there is now going to be this proceeding called a post-grant review proceedings at the patent office, where for a period of 9 months after a patent issues, someone can go in and oppose that motion, oppose that patent. And so that's meant to drive down weak patents getting out of the patent office. And so I think, you know, the people who are really fighting in patent litigation or being sued by their competitors are really going to be watching each other now and fighting more at the patent office than they are in court sometimes.
Very interesting. So Scott or Kevin, how would that CEO or that general counsel start to prepare for all these changes? I mean, this sounds like a pretty significant thing. I mean, I'm just thinking about specifically reading yesterday about a hedge fund manager doing an analysis saying that Green Mountain Coffee, that makes the Keurig machines, is potentially going to have a hard time because they're, you know, they have a patented system, right? It's a closed loop system, and there are other folks who want to get in and make those cups, and there's going to be a big fight over that. And you know, this is an area being watched not just by those that actually work in this area, but those that invest in the area, whatever it is. But so, how can those that are actually operating these companies where they rely on these patents? What should they do to prepare at this point for these changes?
Well, I think these are pretty complicated changes, and I think it's important for the companies to be involved in the regulatory drafting that the Patent and Trademark Office is going to participate in. They send out their regulations for notice and comment, and the first of these will be coming out in about 3.5 more months. And having worked at the Patent Office for quite a number of years, I know that they're very sensitive to suggestions and the thoughts of the public. So getting involved in drafting or getting involved in making suggestions of those regs is a very good idea. The other thing I would suggest is that they need to file early and file often. This is now a first inventor to file system, and if they sit on a great invention and somebody comes up and provides it to the Patent Office first, they're going to be in a less than beneficial position. So I would say that would be the most important thing, as well as keeping records in case they have to show that they did disclose this invention before anyone else. Yeah, Kevin, do you have thoughts?
Yeah, Vince, I mean, I think at the end of the day, the message that comes out of this, because this really is the largest piece of reform to come out in decades, is now is the ideal time for companies to get involved in intellectual property and really start doing it right. And I think this is the best opportunity that's come around for small businesses, large companies, anyone who's innovative, to really get involved in the process, understand it, and hopefully benefit from it.
That's great. Thanks for the overview from both of you today. Yeah, I think it sounds like it's a great thing that once people understand and start working around the new rules, should actually increase innovation and provide a more streamlined way for folks to take their products to market and increase our GDP and grow our economy. So that's a great thing. Nice to have you both with us and look forward to having you on the show down the road.
Thank you very much for having us.
Thanks, Vince. Take care. Take care. Bye.
We'll be back with a conversation about offshore wind.
Markets up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now toll free 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
What's your name worth? The loss of a single patent, trademark, or copyright can cost millions. Make sure your intellectual property is protected. Trust Patton Boggs to manage and protect your most important assets.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Are you looking for innovative ideas on how to achieve your financial dreams? Tune in to Empirical Investing Radio every Thursday afternoon at 2 Pacific, 5 Eastern on the Voice America Business Channel. Join certified financial planners Ken Smith and Ethan Broga to learn how you can obtain financial success. You'll be entertained while you discover techniques to alleviate your financial concerns. Empirical Investing Radio every Thursday at 2 Pacific, 5 Eastern on the Voice America Business Channel.
Technology is changing the way we live our lives and how we do business. On CIO Talk Radio, we talk about the benefits of technology and the great things it allows us to do, as well as its risks. Heard every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Central, 7 a.m. Pacific, Sunjo Gall interviews business leaders and other experts that are shaping the way we use technology. To learn more about this show, visit www.ciotalkradio.com. Keep up with the changing world of technology and listen to CIO Talk Radio with Sunjo Gall. Listen in every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Central, 7 a.m. Pacific, right here on Voice America Business.
The business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio, Voice America Business Network.
Live from
from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
Welcome back to Capital Thinking. We're having a conversation today about innovation, patents, green technology, and with us for our second segment is Nicole Neese, who's an associate at Pattonboggs, and she advises corporations, trade associations, government entities, nonprofits, and universities on legislative and regulatory matters. Nicole focuses on renewable energy, clean tech, agriculture, and food policy at Pattonboggs. We're going to talk about developing policies in support of U.S. offshore wind energy. I think we've all seen at some point driving around the country or flying around these wind farms, but they're usually attached to mountains or in the desert or not necessarily in the water. So we're going to talk a little bit about offshore within our boundaries. Nicole, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Vince. So offshore wind, as you said, you know, we see them a lot on land, but there's also technologies that can put these turbines in the water. It's very common in Europe right now, but it's still a very nascent industry here in the U.S. And when we refer to offshore wind energy projects, we're talking about projects that are constructed in our ocean waters off the coast of the Atlantic, Pacific, or the Gulf Coast, or in the Great Lakes. And while there has been some interest in constructing wind farms off the coast of Oregon and in the Great Lakes, particularly in Lake Erie, most of the activity surrounds potential wind installations off the Atlantic coast from Maine down to Virginia. And that is because the ideal location for an offshore wind farm is one where the water is not too deep, obviously so that we can get these turbines into the seabed, but also one that is protected from severe weather events like hurricanes and one that avoids shipping lanes in areas where there can be significant environmental impacts. And, of course, that's just a list of geographic concerns. What also dictates where an offshore wind farm is constructed is the policies of and potential financial incentives available in the particular state that is authorizing the project. That's typically the state with jurisdiction over the project, and then, of course, incentives at the federal level.
Got it. And so I think some folks may have seen some of the controversy in the last decade about discussing an offshore wind project off Cape Cod.
Mm-hmm.
Can you just update everybody on the current status of offshore wind, where it exists in the U.S.? Are there any U.S. wind farms in existence today? I mean, there was that talk about that one, and did it ever come to fruition?
Yes, you're referring to the Cape Wind Project in Nantucket Sound off the coast of Cape Cod. They are the first such farm that has received all necessary permitting to begin construction, which could occur as soon as in the next year. However, there is no current wind farm offshore anywhere in the United States. The Cape Wind Project will install about 130 turbines in Nantucket Sound. They'll be able to harness enough energy to provide three-quarters of the energy needs of Cape Cod and the islands of Martha's Vineyard and Nantucket. But, of course, that project, as you noted, has not been without controversy. There have been concerns about the project's impact on energy costs, the environment, historical lands, and shoreline water views, all of which have held up the project for over a decade. There are other projects in development off the Atlantic coast, including a blue water wind project off the coast of Delaware that may be the second one in the water. The U.S. Interior Department is getting closer to holding its first ever competitive lease sale for four wind energy areas that are in federal waters off the Atlantic coast in Delaware, Maryland, New Jersey, and Virginia. That's the next step towards the development of additional wind farms. A draft environmental impact statement for all four of those wind energy areas was released this past summer, and that's part of the administration's effort to better streamline the offshore wind energy permitting process going forward.
Got it. So, I mean, on that point about permitting and policies, what kind of policies are important to support the growth of this industry? I mean, obviously it's emerging, right? Because they're, you know, the first farms going in. This isn't something that exists like
most of the on land farms. So what policies could spur this on even more?
Yeah, good question. So, you know, getting energy, getting any new energy industry off the ground, particularly one with very high upfront costs like offshore wind has, can be very difficult. The offshore wind industry is strongly supportive of the so-called Section 1603 program. This program was authorized by the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, which provided grants in lieu of tax credits to support wind energy projects, both onshore and off, among others. However, the 1603 program requires that a project be placed in service or that construction on it has begun by the end of this year. So needless to say, there's some scramble to see if that program can still be utilized for some projects. For those entities that can take advantage of tax credits, the production tax credit, or the so-called PTC, and the investment tax credit, referred to often as the ITC, are also important tools as the industry attempts to finance these early projects. The PTC is available for wind facilities that are placed in service by the end of next year when the credit expires, but the ITC doesn't expire until 2016. However, you know, as you can see, two of the most important policies in support of offshore wind at the federal level currently expire in about a year. And, you know, of course, beyond tax incentives, a national renewable portfolio standard would create much-needed demand for renewable energy and would likely make it easier to finance offshore wind projects. However, it's highly unlikely that this Congress will pass legislation creating a national RPS anytime soon. So in the meantime, state RPS programs are providing an incentive for offshore wind in some regions. So, for example, every state on the Atlantic coast, from Maine to North Carolina, with the exception of Virginia, has an RPS.
So, well, I was thinking about while you were saying that, you know, whether or not this world we're living in Washington, where the politics are focused on deficit reduction and raising revenue, whether or not something, something that doesn't exist yet, but, you know, obviously with the first one going in Massachusetts, but nonetheless, you know, something that doesn't exist is usually easier for policymakers to decide to cut. So I'm wondering whether or not in this deficit environment, plus the fact it's so nascent, I mean, what does this mean for, you know, the ongoing probability of continuation of incentives for offshore wind on the federal level?
Yeah, well, you know, the offshore wind industry is very closely watching these tax credits and the 1603 program that are set to expire soon. And the current congressional focus on deficit reduction makes renewing those expiring tax credits an uphill climb, as you just suggested. Much depends on which so-called baseline the supercommittee uses in developing its recommendations, particularly if the expiration of these tax credits is presumed in the baseline. If it's presumed in this baseline that these tax credits are going to expire, then extending them or renewing them requires additional spending reductions be found to offset them. So needless to say, that is something that is extraordinarily difficult to do in this current fiscal and political environment. There has been some effort to get the supercommittee focused on these expiring credits. Senator Carper has written to the supercommittee asking the members to include his legislation extending the ITC for the first 3,000 megawatts of offshore wind facilities into the supercommittee's bill. However, there is no indication that the committee will do so. The most likely program to be extended is the 1603 program. It's demonstrated positive economic results. And even if that program can't be extended for a period of several years, there is some effort underfoot to at least extend the date by which projects, you know, construction on projects have to begin to take advantage of the current credit. But, you know, if there is not an opportunity to renew these credits to the supercommittee process, there remain other vehicles, including potential tax reform, through which extensions could be provided. You know, the uncertainty in Washington these days about what comes next makes it difficult to forecast the fate of these programs. And, of course, that's much to the chagrin of offshore wind energy developers who need certainty as they plan their investments.
Got it. So setting aside the 1603 program and the idea of tax incentives, I think most people have heard that the federal government over the last few years has made some loan guarantees or investments in new green energy. Has there been any direct federal spending on offshore wind R&D in the last, ever?
Yes, absolutely. The Department of Energy announced Its plan to develop 10,000 megawatts of offshore wind by 2020 and 54,000 megawatts by 2030. So this is a lofty goal to be sure, but to achieve it, the cost of offshore wind energy production has to be decreased. And the best way to do that is through research and development into new technologies in ways that shorten the timeline for development. So the Department of Energy has devoted significant funding to offshore wind R&D just in the past year. This past September, DOE announced that it will award $43 million over the next 5 years to 41 different projects across 20 states. These projects will focus on anything from wind turbine design tools and hardware to gathering more information about U.S. offshore wind industries to reducing market barriers related to supply chain development, transmission, and infrastructure. But, you know, it's been more than just this past year that the DOE has been focused on offshore wind R&D. The department invested in infrastructure necessary to test wind turbine blades and drivetrains. In, for example, Clemson University received $45 million in 2009 to construct a first-of-its-kind very large drivetrain test facility in South Carolina. And South Carolina is certainly one of many states that is seeking to develop an offshore wind industry, which they hope will bring economic development into the state.
Very interesting. So what should people be looking out for, key issues, things to watch for over the next year on this issue?
You know, certainly eyes will be on the Cape Wind project in Massachusetts as it begins construction, as well as projects off the coast of Rhode Island, New Jersey, New York, and Delaware. There are likely to be a lot of lessons learned from these projects that will inform other development. And there will also be important information gleaned from the research and development projects that are funded by DOE that will help, you know, improve and innovate technology utilized in offshore wind projects. You know, once more Atlantic Coast projects get leases from the Interior Department, industry stakeholders will be closely following them to see how these projects are permitted and financed. You know, as you mentioned, Vince, the offshore wind industry is at a very early stage in its development. So much can change in a year, depending on the availability of federal funding and tax incentives. You know, the state of the economy, politics, technology. But certainly the cost of energy will be a key factor. The more expensive energy is from traditional sources, the more appealing offshore wind and other renewable energy sources will appear.
Got it. We have 1 minute left, maybe a little less than a minute here, but I'm originally from the Midwest, and, you know, for folks that haven't seen the Great Lakes, it's amazing. You stand there and there are oceans.
Yeah.
And so we've talked a lot about here about the East Coast, the Acela Corridor. Is there anything that's, you know, happening on this issue in the Great Lakes, potentially?
Yes, there have been collaboratives formed in the Great Lakes region to explore wind in the Great Lakes. There are unique challenges in that region, particularly related to, you know, shipping patterns and severe weather and the impact of ice on turbines that needs to be explored. But, you know, the states in the Lakes region as well as the states in the East Coast, you know, they're looking into offshore wind because they don't necessarily have good land energy resources like coal or natural gas or solar available. And so they're looking for other potential sources of renewable energy that they can harness. And wind is certainly one of those. If you're from Michigan, you know that wind coming off the Great Lakes can be quite strong.
Quite strong. It was like 70-mile-an-hour wind in Chicago yesterday, I saw on the news last night. So they know about wind. Nicole, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Great learning about this very interesting, innovative project, and look forward to having you on the show again soon.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. We'll be back with a conversation about clean tech in commercial office buildings.
Whether the market's up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
From K Street to Wall Street to LaSalle Street, the Patton Boggs team knows how to pull off big business transactions. Come hear what we know.
Patton Boggs covers the world.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Interrogatories.
Prima facie.
Pleadings.
Motion for summary judgment.
E-discovery.
Affirmative defense.
Stipulations.
Ex parte.
Amicus brief.
Subpoena.
Litigation is confusing. Trust the litigation team at Patton Boggs to make sense of it all.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
The same firm that's been navigating the government maze for more than four decades is also the same firm that can help you protect your most important assets. Whether it's a valuable patent, an important copyright, or your next big idea, Patton Boggs is committed to protecting your intellectual property.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network. From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to Capital Thinking. I'm Vince Frilici, sitting in for Kevin O'Neill this week. And we're having a conversation this hour about innovation, patents, green technology. And now we're going to move on to a different slice of green technology, the conversation about green technology in new office buildings and the policy areas and legal areas surrounding that at this moment. We've got an expert in that area, Chris Cheatham. Chris is a construction attorney based in Washington, D.C., and he's a principal at the law office of Christopher Cheatham, LLP. He's worked at some of the largest law firms in the country, including Wyatt, Titer, Hoffman Fitzgerald, and Crowell and Mooring. And he's managed numerous clients regarding the issue of energy risk and contracts and in the LEED accreditation space. All focusing around the issues of green building risk mitigation. So, Chris, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me, Vince. I appreciate the opportunity.
Well, great. So let's start by, can you just tell us what you do in this green building field and what exactly that means to those who might not know in greater detail?
Yeah, so I'm generally, I call myself a construction litigator, but I also assist clients with contracts and risk analysis. And so in the green building field, the issues really are the same. How do you deal with green building risks in contracts? How do you resolve disputes when they do pop up associated with green buildings? A lot of the risk issues out there associated with these new green buildings are very similar to what we've seen in similar construction projects, but it's just a matter of tweaking contracts, inserting new language to deal with that new risk.
Fantastic. What exactly is LEED, by the way, when it comes to buildings, building certification? What does that mean?
So the LEED rating system is a method for essentially certifying that your building is a green building. So the LEED rating system was created in 2000. It really grew in popularity around 2006, 2007. It was created by a nonprofit entity called the United States Green Building Council. And many, many agencies, federal agencies, state governments, as well as commercial private projects now use the LEED rating system essentially as a designation that they have a green building.
Okay. But what does that mean for the building itself? Does that mean that it's got a better AC system that uses less power? What does that mean?
Yeah, so as you're going for certification, LEED certification, you have to document the various components of your building that are sustainable. So you mentioned AC, HVAC systems. Well, energy performance is a big area within green buildings, improving the energy performance, delivering energy savings over a standard building. So you could get LEED points for demonstrating that your building is going to save energy. There's also water usage, saving water, using specific materials in your project. Indoor air quality is another a big factor for green buildings. So it's really those features that make your building more green, more sustainable, and demonstrating that you've incorporated construction techniques to get the LEED points.
Okay, so if I am building a building and I do those things towards LEED certification, is there a tax credit that exists that defers some of the cost of building that building?
There are some incentive programs. Most of them are at the local level. One I like to point out is in Arlington County, which is right outside Washington, D.C. They have what they call a bonus density program, where you get to add additional floor space onto your building if you promise to get certain levels of LEED certification. There are some states, not very many, some cities that have tax incentive programs tied to LEED certification, but a lot of the programs try to either expedite permitting or deliver some other benefit to the building itself instead of, I guess, tax incentives.
Got it. So what are some of the happenings in this industry and in your industry particularly in some of your green building risk mitigation? And maybe tell folks about that who might not know what that means too.
Yeah, so there's when the LEED rating system first became popular, there were a number of jurisdictions, including Washington, D.C., that really wanted to start mandating green buildings. They wanted, it's almost like a building code. How do you mandate a green building code, green buildings? And so a lot of jurisdictions started adopting the LEED rating system almost as a de facto building code. So we're starting to see some reevaluation of those policies. In early 2012, there's a big development coming down the pipe. The International Green Construction Code is going to be released, and I expect many jurisdictions to consider adopting that new green building code in lieu of LEED mandates. Additionally, with the budget constraints right now, you're seeing a lot of federal agencies, state governments, local governments reconsidering their push for LEED buildings, because the LEED certification process does add a little bit of cost onto a project. So you're starting to see a little bit of pushback against the federal agencies that were requiring LEED silver, LEED gold, sometimes LEED platinum for their projects.
Okay. Sorry to interrupt there, but we've only got a few minutes left, and I want to get to something that you were out in the public domain recently, and put a pretty significant article out on the internet about your concerns about the failure of Solyndra. For those who don't know, Solyndra being the California-based solar energy company that received a federal loan guarantee by the Obama administration, and it recently filed for bankruptcy. Can you just tell folks why you're concerned about that? How in the world does that intersect with the world of green building LEED technology and what that means for those that own buildings or run them or may invest in them?
Yeah, so I was comparing the Solyndra bankruptcy and the loan guarantee that the White House had provided. I was comparing that to the green building industry to see if there's other federal programs out there in the green building sector that could possibly have problems like the Solyndra project had problems. I mean, there's this program that was approved by Congress in 2004 called Green Bonds. So there were $2 billion in green bonds issued, and essentially that is financing for green building projects. And those green building projects had to turn around and promise that they would deliver a green building in many aspects. And one of the key components was delivering a large amount of renewable energy to their projects. And so there's right now there's an IRS audit of one of the projects called Destiny USA. There's an audit by the IRS to see if that project complied with the green bond requirements. There's a lot of money at stake if the IRS was to have an adverse ruling. And there's some question as to whether Destiny USA has actually complied with the green bond requirements. They received $238 million in green bond financing. So it's a pretty significant issue that's going to play out towards February 2012 is when we're going to probably hear from the IRS on that project.
Wow, that sounds like it's that could really shake up this industry. Well, Chris, thank you very much for your time today. We appreciate you being with us on Capital Thinking. Look forward to having you on the show again, and thanks for teaching us a little bit about what's going on in this space that, you know, we all either work in or see, but maybe not know what's happening underneath. So have a great day, and thank you all for joining us today on Capital Thinking.
Thank you for joining us for Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. We hope to have you join us again for more insight from Washington. We're here every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Voice America Business Network.